The following presentation is brought to you by the Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to crime thriller writer Stephen Gore, whose latest book is the Harlan Donnelly novel, Night is the Hunter. This is his fourth appearance on Mr. Media. Stick around, and don't piss off the Mexican drug cartel next door. Your interest in theirs may not be properly aligned. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you prefer to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of San Francisco Private Eye fans who are anxiously awaiting a Harlan Donnelly-Barry Bonds crossover in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. For a guy with a bum hip, Harlan Donnelly continues getting around with more ease and is far better at intimidating the criminal element than I am. Now, that probably owes a lot to his creator, Stephen Gore, knowing his way around the San Francisco Bay Area justice system better than most. In his third Donnelly novel, Night is the Hunter, and by the way, Donnelly is now tied with attorney Graham Gage at 3 books apiece, if anyone's keeping score, Gore is in fine literary form, zinging curveballs at loyal readers just when they think they know his irrepressible former cop turned private eye. This time around, Gore has written a tale that bops and weaves so much that you can't possibly know where it's going. It also continues to build Donnelly's backstory. New details may emerge about the crossfire in which he was himself injured years earlier, and we learn more about his personal life. Or do we? Stephen Gore, Mr. Four-Timer himself, welcome back to Mr. Media.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate the chance to talk to you again.
I think we were both surprised how many times it's been now. It's like your piece of the furniture around here.
I was really surprised.
For anyone who wants to check, it's one audio appearance and 3 video appearances. So go if you're new to Steve, go look it up. It'll be well worth your time. So, Steve, help me out here. Why can't poor old Harlan Donnelly have a day off? I mean, Ferris Bueller got a day off. Hasn't he earned some R&R? Does he always have to be chasing down, criminals? People want to kill him?
He does get days off. The problem is, and frankly, he wants a day off. There's a certain point in this book when he says, what am I doing? Why don't I just take my girlfriend, sell the house, move back up north? He's moved up to Mount Shasta, where he runs a cafe after he got hurt. And he's just, why am I doing this? And he sort of, he realizes he only got in the first case because of one thing. And because of something in the first case, he ends up in the second one. Because something in the second one, he ends up in the third one. And he's saying, enough already. but he has a strong sense of obligation. And I think that's what keeps him coming back.
Also, how does he pay his bills? I mean, the cafe can't be enough, and he's certainly not getting paid anything for this case.
Well, he doesn't spend a lot of money.
I don't know if I'm buying that answer.
Well, let me think. In this book, he does some driving. He takes a plane trip to L.A.
Yeah.
He drives up to Northern California. Yeah, it's not much.
Yeah, but I mean, there's no billable hours in this book.
Well, no, he's not really a private investigator. He's he's just an ex-detective. But he acts as if he is.
Well, that's
Though he doesn't have a license and doesn't want to get re-entangled in the system as a whole by becoming a private investigator.
Well, and I mean, it's not like he's living off his dad's money. I suspect he wouldn't take money from his dad if he could. And his other income is what, his retirement pension? That can't be enough to be zipping up and down the coast of California too often.
Well, pensions for law enforcement in California are surprisingly good.
All right.
Well, because I know, because when years ago, I was an investigator with the public defender's office out here, and our pay was tied to detectives' pay in the county, all of us, our office, the DA inspectors, sheriff's department, whatever. And I mean, we were treated really well.
Okay.
Both in terms of you know the healthcare and cars and retirement, which was the rule was you could retire at 50 with 2% of your salary for each year worked or something. And so if you work 30 years, I mean, the retirement was phenomenal. I mean, you've got friends that travel the world on their police retirement. So it's fine.
It's that and the $12 burgers at Mount Shasta, right?
right.
He makes a damn good burger. I guess that's the... All right. So you're not offended, though, when I referred him as a PI. I mean, I know he's not technically a PI, but he pretty much in all these novels, he functions as a PI.
He functions like it, but... The Gage is the PI, and with the PI, you're saying, this is what I want to do. I want to do investigations. I want to get paid for it. This is how I make my living. And
that's
it's sort
what
of
you did.
That's what I did. But Donnelly isn't that kind of a guy. I mean, he left when he's injured, 10 years before the book starts.
Right.
And he... tries to convince the department to keep him when, despite the injury, they say no. And he says, well, enough. And he moves north and he opens his cafe and he wants to live a small private life. And, but then a friend of his up there has a problem and he ends up in the middle of it. And it's one thing after another.
I'm hoping that in the fourth Donnelly book, we get a little, even if it's just an aside to me, a little explanation of how he can afford to do all this work without any pay. That's all. That's all I'm asking for.
Okay.
I think, three books in, I think it's time to find out how this man paid. For all we know, because I wanted to ask you, I mean, for all we know, he's this expert on the Mexican drug trade and the cartels, because maybe that's where he's getting his income. Maybe he's picking up a little piece there. I mean, I wanted to ask you, without violating your own Fifth Amendment right, how do you know so much about how these things work? And by the way, good imagination is a perfectly acceptable answer.
I wish I had that imagination, to tell you the truth. Well, first of all, early in my career, we all start out in street crimes, which is low-level drug trafficking. And a lot of it involves you know some of the characters of the level in this book, sort of street sales, and then the level just above. And then when I went private, I ended up getting hired in racketeering cases, and those drug trafficking conspiracies, and those involved Mexican mafia and whatever else. And so those you get a very close up look, because you end up talking to all the defendants, you end up interviewing people, so you have a lot of firsthand experience with these folks, in addition to what you get in discovery from the government. I was always hired by the defense, and so you'd have wiretaps you listen to and videotapes and whatever, and you go over this stuff with the defendants. What do you mean by this? What do you mean by that? And so it's a lot of hands-on experience. So for the book, what I try to do is sort of get the inner logic of how gangs work. And I try to work in this book the history and how these gangs began really is, in some ways defensive. A lot of them arose out of attempts to protect workers working out in the fields. 40 years ago, 50 years ago, the employers were smuggling people across the border to work in the fields. They were, and they became victims. These were, once people get over here, they have no rights, no protections, whatever. Same thing in prisons. You've got these people coming up, end up in prison, and without protection. And so you've got these gangs form and whatever. So I'm looking for that, the logic and what seduces people I don't want to say seduces, why people in certain situations seek the protection of gangs. Sometimes it's for power, and sometimes it's for protection. And I try to capture with some of these characters, particularly some of these younger characters, what they were thinking, and then how they get trapped.
Well, in this book particularly, I mean, it's really interesting. We do get inside the head of a number of these characters. I didn't go back and compare, but I felt like this time I had a much deeper understanding of the motivation of a lot of the characters outside of Donnelly. Obviously, we know what's going on in his head, sort of, to the degree that you let us in on what's going on. And there's some certain things, of course, you don't tell us because that would give it away. But I did feel like we had a greater understanding of, their motivations and what, brought them into the life.
I think that's true. Part of the problem of the previous book is the character whose motivations Donnelly is trying to understand is already dead when the story starts. So you don't get inside of that his head. You only get sort of the third person of people talking about him. And there's some good characters in those books, but I see what you mean.
All right, and so let's talk about something else that distinguishes this book. I don't know if the readers are going to get this note. I don't recall, but the publisher sent a note to reviewers and people like myself from you, explaining that you wanted to do something different this time. Can you talk a little about that?
Well, let's see. I don't think I was trying to do something different.
Well, I mean, to
talk about what I was trying to do and be more explicit about it, which has to do with realism. That the book is kind of challenging because I want readers to. There's some hard legal concepts in this book.
Yes.
And I want to use Donnelly to teach, and the judge in the book, to teach the reader the concepts, because those are the concepts that the characters are going to be thinking in as the book goes on. And that's the way the real world works in crime and investigations and all that. That's the context, is the law. And so I wanted to teach people that stuff. What I really have to offer as a writer is realism. I mean, because I've been there and I've done that stuff. And it's really a problem. Realism is a problem. I mean, it really is a problem when you want to write genre fiction, because readers want to see, you know, tensions rise, but investigators want to lower tension, because nobody's going to talk to you if you come in and jam them. Nobody's going to talk if you act out anything. So there certainly is tension, but it's in your head. You certainly don't want to show it. I mean, there are circumstances where you raise tension, but it's a calculated thing. It's not a kind of an impulsive sort of our manner of a, sort of approaching the world. And that's hard to do, because you need the. I mean, one thing that makes Michael Connelly really superior, in my mind, is that he can see the tension in every scene he writes, and sometimes he just leaves it on the page, that he doesn't exploit it with somebody reacting to it. I mean, he can have a dog come into the room, and the reader's thinking, is this dog dangerous, right? And then the dog walks out again. So he's really good at exploiting that. Unfortunately, you know, but in most of investigative life, it really is the dog walking in and walking out again without doing anything.
I keep hoping the dog is going to talk.
The dog, right? So realism is hard. It's really hard to do, both in terms of, the law and procedure and all that. And I wanted to be authentic. And the really, really hard concept of this book is called implied malice. It's a reckless disregard for human life. It seems pretty simple, but nobody's ever written a novel based on that, because it turns out to be really complicated. And so you really require kind of the faith of the reader to say, you know, the trust of the reader, this is going to pay off. If you just remember a couple of this lecture on implied malice, it's really going to pay off. Not, you know, you're not going to have to wait to the end of the book. You're going to see the thing develop as you go.
This is definitely a more, I was going to say trying, but it's not a try. It's as smooth a book to read as any of the others, but there are more complicated ideas that you have to wrap your head around. And I have to admit, there were points at which I was just like, okay, I'm just going along. Because I don't know that I'm getting this, but I want to keep reading. So,
Well, what it's doubly complicated, because the underlying sort of theme of the book is prosecutorial misconduct. The first book was sort of a systemic issue of how the mentally ill get treated in the criminal justice system. The second one was a corruption on the part of the defense attorney. And this one is, you know, focused on the prosecution. And it's a real problem. I mean, recently we had the Chief Justice of the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals out here describe prosecutorial misconduct as an epidemic in the Ninth Circuit. And he's serious, because case after case after case are coming up in which prosecutors have concealed evidence, have misled the court, have even committed perjury trying to defend their convictions. It's a really serious issue. And so, you know, so there's a double look at the law here, not only this issue of applied malice, but how it applies to another crime, which is, you know, suppressing evidence, suborning perjury, and whatever else. So, in fact, we recently had a case here that came out of California that ended up in a federal court, appeals court, in which for 10 years, the attorney general's office tried to keep the appeals court from finding out that the prosecutor in the case had committed perjury. And then when it finally got to the appeals court, the panel said to the attorney from the attorney general, well, you tell the attorney general about this particular case, and then let's see what happens. And of course, the next day, attorney general's office dropped their opposition. It was an attempt to get a new trial, dropped their opposition to the new trial. So it's a problem. And it just happened that at the same time the book came out, the appeals court was dealing with this issue.
Well, another thing that you deal with is you talk a lot about, and I think we get a strong sense of your point of view, is on the qualifications of death row attorneys, death row lawyers. You do not seem very impressed with the quality of a lot of these people, based on what I'm reading in the book.
Well, there are, like any field, there's a certain percentage that are the best. I mean, that do their work excellently, and then it drops down. It's the same in any other field. There are two problems in capital criminal defense. One is that the outcomes are arbitrary. The best attorney in the world defending the weakest case can still end up with his client up on death row. It's just arbitrary. You don't know how you just it is just arbitrary. The worst of the worst. The worst murderers I have ever met never made it to death row. And I 30 years ago I worked on these cases and swore off when I realized how arbitrary it was. That's the first thing. The second thing is capital defense lawyers are great about building their own reputations. And unfortunately, novelists fall for it. And they make these guys and women the best of the best. Well, they're not the best of the best. Virtually all these death penalty cases are handled by lawyers who are appointed by the court. So they're making, what, $50 an hour, $75 an hour? What do a top attorneys charge? $600 to $1,000 an hour. So those people are not going to do these cases unless they have some moral commitment to it. And there's a couple that do in California and are very heroic in their efforts, though I wish they wouldn't do it. I wish people would just stop doing it, because if defense attorneys didn't defend these cases, nobody's ever going to get put to death. It's just arbitrary. People are getting put to death in Texas for stuff that they do 15 years for out here.
Well, and you can't compare Texas to anywhere else in the country. It's like they used to say about Florida, the rules are different there. Everything is different there. Nothing makes sense in the larger context of the United States.
Right.
Love you, Texas, but sorry.
Right. So obviously I'm a death penalty opponent. I know these guys. I probably did 150 maybe homicides in various capacities in my career. Some of these are just truly awful, horrendous people that ought to be locked up forever. It always amazes me that people who most believe in human fallibility also believe in executing people. You know, they compare the human fallible to the perfect God, and then want to put themselves in God's place and start executing people based on eyewitness testimony, which is often wrong, evidence that can be mishandled, witnesses that lie. So I just...
Well, if we're going to start talking about human beings as hypocrites, I'm afraid we're going to need a much longer show.
Right. Yeah.
All right, so let's come back around to talking about the fictional world. I'm just kind of curious, with either Donnelly or Gage, how do you determine the width and breadth of danger that you put each in, knowing, at this point anyway, that you still plan to do another book with them? I mean, Donnelly, for example, he's got this problem with his hip where he was shot, right? So you know he's already hobbled a bit. You know he's not going to go racing down the street after somebody. He might just kind of skip along. And so you're not likely to get him shot in the other hip, because he'll never be able to move from point to point.
Right.
But he's always in danger. I mean, there's always, he's always come against tough guys. How do you decide, how to draw the line? Where to put the line?
It's really what the scene is, I guess. It's the logic of the story that dictates that. You know, I have a really hard time with violence, because in the real investigative world, there's very little of it. You know, you can't get life insurance. The insurance companies think it's more dangerous than it is, but in real life, it isn't. Most of it is ordinary, but it's, you know, it's part of the genre. You have to, I mean, it, yeah, I have a problem with that. You know, I've certainly been in difficult situations in my career. But it's, the thing is, violence is quick. It's, you know, most people go down at one punch. And in most, you know, in most novels, there's fighting back and forth and shooting back and forth. That's just not the way the world works. So I'm not good at that.
But how do you contain that for your characters? I mean, because people do get beaten up in stories. It's right. You know, it's not going to be Donnelly most cases.
Right.
I guess it's kind of a hypothetical question, but are you always conscious of the fact that you can't really beat up this guy too much more because you need him to keep coming back? There's no one else to tell the story.
Well, he can get shot and healed. Gage, in the last Gage book, let me think. In one Gage book, he gets stabbed. We know that early in his career he got shot. How only he's going to come out in next year's book, the next Gage book, as a flashback to explain the plot. Let's see. Yeah, I can't, as I'm thinking, sitting here now, I can't think. But it's all right. I mean, they can get hurt as long as they recover. As long as it's debilitating.
I mean, Donnelly, there's a kind of a B or C storyline here where there's references back to when he was shot. He was in the crossfire. I don't want to talk too much about it because I don't want to give anything away one way or the other. But it's interesting that you're not letting go of that story yet. We haven't learned one way or the other. We haven't learned everything that went on there, or at least maybe he doesn't know if he knows everything.
Well, he's not satisfied. And as the books go on, you realize that he's been relying on unreliable people for an explanation. And with this book, you at least understand the context, because that shooting ends up being part of this long-standing gang war between the Norteños and Serenos. And it's a 30-year-long war that's cost 1,000 lives and continues until today. So he now understands it in that context and understands how the crime, and at least one of the crimes in the book, followed from that incident. And he realizes more now that the people he was relying on for an explanation were lying about some things.
Now there's another B story in the book, if you will, involving Donnelly's sometimes nefarious father.
Don, right?
I always hesitate to give away too much, but there is a lot of talk about Alzheimer's. Is this something you wanted to write about for a particular reason, or it just had nothing to do with you and just something you felt fit the plot?
Well, no, it's something I wanted to write about. You know, we all, when you get to a certain age, you have family members that are in that are in that range of various forms of dementia.
Not you and I.
Not you and I personally, but if we live long enough. So it's been part of my experience. And also, I have always been troubled by Ronald Reagan's last years when he said things and did things that were really nonsensical. You know, he talked about, you know, going to visit, you know, at the end of the war, going in with the troops to see concentration camps. Well, he wasn't there. It's something he'd seen in a movie. You know, he goes to Bitburg, that cemetery in Germany with these SS soldiers, and he says, well, there's no one alive today that was even alive during those years. Well, he was. And there was, you know, incident after incident like this, and you can see that his mind was deteriorating, and his wife was trying to protect him, isolate him from the public, and whatever else. His daughter was really beside herself, distraught. And that sort of became the model for this judge and what he's struggling with. And that with people with dementia, they remember, you know, things from 30 to 50 years ago very well. They can't remember things more recently, and particularly the more recent, the less they can remember. And so this poor judge is going back to something 20 years ago. And so it's something where he remembers and does remember. So Donnelly has to, is both looking at things through the judge's memory, what he has, but also has to go around to find out what the facts are.
See, and, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, I was going to say, did you have to do a lot of research on Alzheimer's to, you know, work around your intended plot?
Not directly for the book, but in order to understand some relatives. And one of which my wife is most directly responsible for. So we both did a lot of reading and, you know, went to a lot of lectures and whatever else on how it works. I wanted that part of the book to be accurate also.
And I mean, so this is six books down now, and I know we'll talk about, there's another book that's finished, and you've got a book of short stories you're just finishing up. How has your writing changed over this period of time in terms of, are you writing faster, or is it taking you longer? Are you rewriting more or less? Are you researching more or less? You know, what's different from when you started doing this, completely out of your element when you started, basically?
Well, I think the writing is better. I think it flows better. I think the characters are deeper. I think you're right about that. I think I understand more about what I'm doing now, not in terms of writing, but in terms of the logic of the stories than I did when I started. What I mean is, I've been now retired from investigations for 5 years. And during that time, I've done a lot of reading and thinking about sort of the philosophical aspects of that world. So I understand more now about what I was thinking then and what was important to me then. So I think these books are just a lot deeper every which way. I went to graduate school at Berkeley, 40 years ago in political philosophy. And I was more interested even back then in the philosophy side rather than the political side. And I tried teaching for a while and just too frictionless. I like being out where the world pushed back a little bit. So I left teaching and then, you know, got involved in the criminal justice system. But I've always kept up, always been reading in philosophy, and a lot of very interesting things have happened in the last 20 or 30 years. I've been relying on that as I think about these books and trying to understand my own career through that perspective. And so I think it's made me a better writer.
Well, and I want to talk to you before we start to wrap up. Before we went live with the interview, we were talking about how difficult it can be to be someone who's written characters, private eyes or, you know, investigators, this kind of thing, and then try to write literary fiction, which is something you're very interested in. How are you made aware that it's difficult? I mean, you can sit down and write anything you want, but is it the perception of readers, is it the perception of publishers and editors? How do you recognize that's going on?
I think it's learning from the experience of other writers who tried the same thing. Let me say this. There is something real about the problem of making a transition from sort of crime writing to literary mainstream writing, particularly when your background is in investigations. Because one thing that kind of life does, it really knocks the lyricism out of you. I mean, it's a noun and verb world. It's not adjectives and adverbs. It really is it does knock it out of you, and it's hard to get it back. So it's a struggle to sort of soften stories enough for the literary market. I think I'll break through. I've written some stories on pretty heavy philosophical themes that have to do with, obligation and how the world, sort of fits together. And one of my, I recently sold to Gray's Sporting Journal, which is the literary magazine of the outdoor world. And I was really thrilled to see that at least one editor in that world saw that a crime writer could write something that would appeal to a different audience, particularly, a pretty sophisticated audience, because it's a magazine. I think its circulation is about 30,000. 80% of the readers have a bachelor's degree. 40% have advanced degrees. So it's a good test. I mean, these are going to be smart people, and I'll hear whether the story has it or not. We'll see. I hope so. I'm trying to do something that I think is different, but we all think we're special.
All right. So before we wrap up, you've got two books, in the funnel, I guess, right? Is the next one, is it a Graham Gage?
The next one is a Graham Gage. In fact, I just got an email from my editor saying time to get started on the 2016 catalog. So they don't give you any rest. This book just came out a month and a half ago or so.
Right.
Maybe 2 months ago. And you're already on the next one.
Listen, you don't want to complain about not getting rest, because the minute they give you rest, they forget about you and they move on. So.
Oh, no, I don't mind. Every time they say, let's get ready and go, I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled that they like it. I'm thrilled that readers like it. The reviews of this book really are just, some of them have really been moving, where you get readers who really get it and reviewers, there's a lot of crime review sites around, of really smart, conscientious people. And it's just amazing. I mean, the people get it. They lose sleep over this book. Well, I really appreciate that. I just, it makes it worthwhile.
That's great.
So it's a kick when the editor says, well, we're ready to go again. So I appreciate it.
All right. Well, folks, listen, you can find Steve Gore's latest Harlan Donnelly novel, Night is the Hunter, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching the show, you know how this works. If you're watching the show at MrMedia.com, either to the left or to the right, under my friend Steve, you'll see the cover of the book. You can click on it right now. You can download it as an ebook immediately, or you can have the physical book sent to you. I understand that they have drones now at Amazon. They can get you the book in 30 minutes right to your doorstep. If that's not true, don't hold me to it, but it's just what I hear, folks. So anyway, you can get it at a great price at MrMedia.com. The website, stephengore.com?
Yeah.
Okay. Are you Twitter, Facebook? people find you?
I have a Facebook under Stephen Gore. I'm not as conscientious as I should be. I'm not a media guy the way you are. I just haven't mastered all you have in this.
Few have, Steve. Few have.
Uh-huh.
All right. But people can find you on the old internet. That's the important thing.
Yeah. They
can. All right. And, Steve, listen, four times. Next time, you're coming up to Peter Gallenbach territory. So, you know, we'll look forward to that. I don't imagine it'll be very long before we see you back here again.
Good, thanks. This is great. I always get it's a kick talking to you every time.
It's our pleasure. And thanks, as always, for being on Mr. Media.
You're welcome.
This is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank News and Comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry, and some make me sad, and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at BuzzBurbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Weekday mornings right here on the Realm Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the George and Tony Entertainment Show. Prepare for awesome mediocrity.
We're the Cousin Oliver of the Realm Network. I'm George.
And I'm Tony.
And we're a weekly family-friendly podcast about pop culture.
From our point of view.
At RealmNetwork.com, the George and Tony Entertainment Show from the Realm Network.
This is Snake. Do you read me, Otacon?
Loud and clear, Snake.
Did you listen to the latest episode of the Gaming Marathon on the Realm Network?
Of course. They really know their stuff about gaming, especially that Usid guy.
Yeah, but that Chirac guy is a real jerk. I don't like him.
Regardless, their reviews are spot on and they tell it like it is.
That's for sure.
What happened, Snake? Were you spotted?
Nah, it's just Lowell Meltzer crying about the O's again.
Whew, close call.
I better continue the search for Metal Gear, but keep listening to the Gaming Marathon each week.
You got it, Snake.
New every Monday afternoon right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
What you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
These are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot. Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
Resistance is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights.